563, 563 would be our song for reading Psalm 9. 563, Jesus, name above all names.
Well, I'm pretty sure we will finish tonight this series that we've been on for some time now in what we've called Answering Questions About the Bible. And I'll just go ahead and tell you, we may even have time to sort of have a brief introduction to our next study tonight. But what we're going to go to next will be quite a change of pace from this. It's been a number of years since we had a study on the Psalms. And so we probably will not take the time to look at all 150 of the Psalms in this study, but I can guarantee you it's a very rewarding study. And just this afternoon, Steph and I were talking about that, and both said pretty much that every time we study the Psalms, we come away thinking, I need to read the book of Psalms more often. There's just so much there. It's one of the most enriching studies, I think, that we can engage in. So the Lord willing, we'll plan to spend several weeks looking at the Psalms and some of the things that they have that's certainly applicable to our lives today. We'd gotten last week up to and including talking about the King James translation, the one that probably many of us grew up with and many still use today. And I think in some of what we said last week, we'll notice in just a few moments here that those who felt the need for updating it recognize its great value. The King James Version has been maligned by some as if it was of no value. It was basically the only English Bible for 2.5 centuries, the predominant one at least, for over 2 centuries. And I have no quibble with anyone who still insists that they would prefer the King James over some of the newer translations. But the fact is I have no idea how many English translations exist today. They're just coming out constantly. I just learned about a new one this week. If you're interested in the Word on the Street, Stefan went to the book sale at the library last week, and they had a translation called Word on the Street, and it is something else. And there have just been a lot of translations like that that are certainly not scholarly and not very true to the original. But I think, as we briefly talked about last week, and that's where we'll begin tonight, there are some valid reasons for wanting to upgrade our English translation. So that's what we'll talk about. As we noticed last week, after 2.5 centuries, there was considerable thinking among Greek scholars and preachers and Bible students that there might be a need for a new English translation to bring the King James Version of today. And there were basically three reasons for that. One was, as we said last week, that languages change. We can even see some changes probably in our lifetime. And certainly over the course of centuries, the English language wasn't the same in 1885 as it was in 1611. So that was one reason. And then that we've talked a lot about the manuscripts. Many of these better manuscripts, as most textual critics view them, were not even known in 1611. So there was much more and better manuscript evidence later. And then also the study of those ancient languages had advanced, and so scholars knew more how to translate Greek and Hebrew into English and various other languages. So in 1870, there was a motion there in at the upper house of the Convocation of Canterbury to begin work on revising the King James Version. They made up two committees, 27 scholars on each one. Not surprisingly, there were many from the Church of England, but there were also Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians and Unitarians and Congregationalists. If we get through, and I think we will tonight, one of the last things I want us to think about is what are some of the ways to evaluate translations. And one of them clearly is if you have diversity, if you have, first of all, more than one person doing the work, and then that you have checks and balances, such as would be where you have people with different backgrounds. If there's a tendency maybe sometimes to put some sort of a bias on some passage by some group, the other groups would tend to sort of balance that out and correct that. So in July of that year, they invited some American scholars to come take part in this translation. And the result was what became to be called the English Revised Version. 1881, New Testament came out, 1885, the Old Testament. As we've already suggested, it took advantage of the manuscripts that had been discovered since 1611. Almost 6,000 differences in the Greek text that they used versus what the King James translators used, what's often called the Textus Receptus that was the basis of the King James Version. And here's the objective, this is a quote, to introduce as few alterations as possible in the text of the Authorized Version consistently with faithfulness. So they did not intend to completely abandon everything the King James translators had done, but just to see where they thought they could make improvements. And the result was, when it's all said and done, over 36,000 changes were made to the New Testament. So it was a significant revision. And here's some of the things that they said. The need and desirableness of a new revision are now almost generally admitted, at least by those who are best acquainted with the Bible in its original languages. The object is to make a good translation still better, more accurate and self-consistent, and to bring it up to the present standard of biblical scholarship. Volumes instead of pages might be easily written to illustrate the existing defects of the, quote, authorized version. Of course, authorized, if you look in the front of your King James Bible, you'll see it was authorized by King James I. And they went on to say, the most ardent admirers of the King James Version do not claim for it a perfection and infallibility. I went to a debate many, many years ago, actually, in which I thought rather foolishly, a gospel preacher debated in defense of the King James translation. I wouldn't want to do that, but that's what they're saying, that there are, even its admirers recognize it wasn't perfect in their way. It has a very considerable number of errors, defects, and obscurities. You say, well, that sounds sort of critical, and I guess it is. But they want to say it was the best translation which could be made at the beginning of the 17th century, but it could be greatly improved with the enlarged facilities of the present age. Well, these Americans that were asked to come over and take part in this, as you might expect, if you ever try to talk to somebody from England that speaks a different English than we do, the Americans would be saying, well, that's not the way we would say it over across the pond. And so there are many preferred readings that were different from what the English scholars would make. And about 1,000 of them, they got the English scholars to agree to put it in the translation that way. But there were a number of others that they did not see fit to put in. And so they put them in an appendix at the end of the translation. And then there was an agreement that after 14 years, the Americans could come out with their own translation that would incorporate all of the things they thought would better suit American readers. And so that's what the American Standard, the old 1901 American Standard, was the result of that. It's basically the English Standard Version, English Revised Version, getting ahead of myself, with the Americans' preferred readings. It's very accurate, it's very literal. It does not have, admittedly, the style and beauty of the King James Version. I grew up for many, many years hearing and reading, quoting from the King James. It certainly has a stylistic elegance, some would even call it. Some have sort of said, the halfway tongue-in-cheek, that the American Standard Version is strong in Greek and weak in English. And by that, they meant that they felt like they followed too slavishly close. Let me just go ahead and say something. I know all of you people have had experience in dealing with different languages and trying to translate from one language to another. And it's not a simple, straightforward process, is it? That is to say, you're not just simply saying word for word, here's this word, you plug that word in, here's this word, you plug that word in. It's much more complex and sophisticated than that, especially when you're dealing with figures of speech and idioms and things like that. If you rendered them literally, it wouldn't make much sense in the other language. And so the question that always comes up is how closely should the translators follow peculiarities of the Greek language in putting it in English. And some think American Standard Version followed it too closely. Well, following this was the Revised Standard Version. Some here may even remember when it came out in the late 40s and early 50s. Very controversial. There were 32 scholars that worked on this from 20 university and theological schools. There was an advisory board of 50. They used that's what they call an eclectic text. That is to say, they picked from various manuscripts the ones they thought were the best. It was a revision of the English Revised and American Standard. That's what they're doing, is taking it one step forward. But one of the things about it, there were men like Edgar Goodspeed and some others who were very liberal theologically that worked on this. And so some felt like that neo-Orthodox theology crept in there. And the one that was just the battleground for so long was Isaiah 9:14, where instead of a virgin shall conceive, they took the word virgin out. And some felt that was their attempt to try to eliminate the virgin birth of Jesus from the text. And there's not going into all the issues about how to best translate that Hebrew word. But the National Council of Churches endorsed it, which is, I would think, it's not necessarily a good recommendation. But in 1990, they came out with another one. It was a revision of that called the New Revised Standard Version. The one that a lot of us are using now is the New American Standard Version. And the name sort of suggests what the Lockman Foundation attempted to do back in the 60s and 70s was to take the 1901 American Standard Version and update it. At first, they wouldn't tell the names of the translators. And I don't know why. In fact, I wrote a letter many years ago to the Lockman Foundation. They wrote back politely and said, we prefer not to tell. Well, since then, that's come out. They're now known who they were. They were trying to get people interested once again in the American Standard Version. It sort of died away. So sometimes it's not quite as literal as the American Standard Version. Very often you'll find marginal notes that will indicate, or it could mean, it could read this way. In 1995, they came out with the updated. In fact, if you go into a bookstore today, you'll very likely see the New American Standard updated version from 1995. I think the New American Standard Version is a very good translation. There are one or two places I think they didn't do a very good job. They're human beings. I know some of you are using the New King James Version, and it is based on the same text that the King James was based on. It came out, the New Testament Psalms, in 1980. 2 years later, the Old Testament was revised. It was the fifth major revision of the King James Version. Remember, we talked about that last week, how many early on, even in the 17th century, there are many revisions. So this is a one that takes the 1769 edition and updates it. 130 scholars took part in this, but they were also considering the latest Hebrew and Greek text to compare with what the the original King James translator used. And they eliminated some of the archaic readings, the these and the thous, the s and the s and so forth. I looked this afternoon somewhere in my library, and I'll find it, maybe make a copy and let you see it. A list that I had a number of years ago, about 3 or 4 pages long, of readings in the King James Version that if you did not know, if you had not been schooled and taught this is what it means, the way we speak today, you wouldn't know what it means. There's probably more of them than most people realize. And some of them, I mean, obviously, the and thou, we know what that means, but they just tried to bring the language up to modern times. So this is kind of what we just talked about up to this point. You can see kind of there how the family tree is, the King James, then the English Revised, and then the American Standard, and off of that the Revised Standard, the New Revised, and then the New American Standard, and then later the New King James. Well, certainly since the 1980s, there's been a lot more that's taken place. So let's briefly mention some of those. I haven't stopped to give anybody a chance to ask you questions. Anybody want to add anything to what we've talked about so far? Okay. New International Version. And I can tell you, brethren, have been very much divided on this. Jack Lewis, member of the church, a great scholar, had a part. I'm not sure exactly what his role was, but he had a part in the NIV as an advisor, I think. And he wrote a book, a pretty good-sized book, about the Bible in English up to the NIV. And he's defensive of it. He thinks it was unfairly criticized. It received a lot of the same kind of criticisms that the Revised Standard Version received when it first came out. I know some gospel preachers that absolutely will not use NIV. They think it has a lot of Calvinistic leanings in its translation. One of them that's been the real object of a lot of criticism is the Greek word sarx, which means flesh. There is a perfectly good English word that corresponds to Greek sarx. It's flesh. Well, the NIV translators consistently, repeatedly translate that sinful nature. And in some context, that would certainly lead one toward the Calvinistic idea about inherited sin. They called it idiomatic 20th century English. And again, there were a number of men that worked on it, over 100 scholars of various affiliations. They had a procedure that I think was good. I'm convinced from what I've read that they were trying very hard to, as accurately as possible, reproduce in modern English. And so they had an intermediate editorial committee and then a general editorial committee, and then a committee on France. They would compare and review one another's works. The NIV actually has gone through a history since that time, and I don't want to belabor the point too much, but there was a 1984 update. It was revised, the NIV was, in 1984. And then it was revised again in 2002 and 2005, Old Testament, New Testament. And that was called briefly the TNIV, today's International Version, and it was horrible. It tried, you know what gender inclusive means in translations? Some of these, there are a lot of factors involved in this, change in ownership and all that, but some of these, I would say some of them probably were sort of what we call feminists, didn't like the masculine pronouns and so forth in the Bible, so they tried to smooth all that out and make it gender neutral, some call it. And there was a lot of criticism. It didn't last very long. It was a big flop. In 2011, it was revised again. And I'd forgotten, but just this afternoon I ran across, going through my files, resolution by the Southern Baptist Convention when the 2011 NIV came out. And basically what they're saying is resolve. They didn't think it was any good. They thought it was not an accurate translation. I don't think the NIV... the ones I have are older editions, but I don't think it's probably as bad as some made it out to be. But I certainly wouldn't recommend it as much as I would like the New American Standard Version that we were talking about a while ago. Some of these others, the New English Bible, they picked that date because that was the 350th anniversary of the King James Version, 1961. But they used a new principle translation. They didn't do word for word. They did a sense for sense. That doesn't sound too bad, but... some call it, they talk about dynamic equivalent, and that's sort of a vague, subjective concept. You know, here's what I think Paul meant to say, and so I'll just word it how I think it ought to be worded. And that's not quite the same as a literal translation. That's the way the New English Bible was done. They sometimes rearrange the text. At times they would even put in the margin probable reading. But it was widely criticized for good reason. They revised it again in 1989. I would not recommend that New English Bible. Probably not very many people have ever even seen one. Another one, this is very popular when it came out back in the 60s and 70s, called the popular, kind of like word from the street, they call it Good News for Modern Man, but it's actually called it Today's English Version. And they did use dynamic equivalence, which is a very loose kind of translation, but it was very widely distributed by denominational groups back in the 70s. Now the English Standard, and this is one that is really becoming popular, and I think it's a good translation. But when I first heard about it, found out that what it was an attempt to update the Revised Standard Version that we talked about earlier. And I thought, well, Revised Standard had its weaknesses. But as this quote says, it was an evangelical revision of the Revised Standard Version, bringing up some of the archaic language, but they called it an essentially literal translation. And they had a team of over 100 people. It has been widely praised by a conservative scholar. I think the English Standard Version is a good translation. I found one or two places in it that I'm not sure. I think they could have done a better job of translating than they did. But I could recommend English Standard. I know some of you use it. Well, anything on the translation, that's certainly not all the list. Let me just go ahead and look at this. Here's some others that you may have heard of. The Living Bible, you remember that? Have you heard about the Living Bible? A man named Kenneth Taylor did this. As I've been told, he was riding to and from work on I think he worked for the Moody Institute. I'm not sure about that, but on the subway, and he would just work going as he was commuting. It's a one-man translation. It's not very scholarly. I think he was well-intended, but it's very loose paraphrase. J.B. Phillips' translation, one-man translation. Phillips thought one time in 1 Corinthians that Paul made a slip of the pen, so he corrected it for him. The Amplified Bible is a paraphrase. If you've ever seen one of those, you know that they'll put things in the text that's not even there, but they just thought it kind of fits. Do you know who put out the New World Translation? That's Jehovah's Witnesses. And the whole purpose of the New World Translation was to fix some verses of Scripture that didn't fit their theology, their doctrine, so it's worthless. There have been a couple of recent, we talked about the Reims Douay Catholic version last week. There have been some recent Catholic translations, the Jerusalem Bible, the New American Bible. I think the translations are not so bad, but they have a lot of footnotes in which they explain that the text says elder, but really it's priest, things like that. Berkeley version, Moffat, that's a one man, Edgar Goodspeed, one man, and on it goes. There are many of them. Well, let's just close with this. The question, obviously the answer to this would seem to be what we've already seen. Are some better than others? Well, of course they are. So here are some of the criteria I would say you need to consider when you pick a translation. First of all, I've already suggested, was it done by one man, or was it a group of people? And as you look at the group, look at the diversity and the checks and balances that might be there. Even one man making a translation, it's sort of inherent in that this, you might make mistakes and somebody else wouldn't be there to catch them. Are the translators possibly biased? What were suggested? What kind of translation is it? Is it a strict literal translation? Now, it's hard to draw a sharp line of demarcation between that and a dynamic equivalent and dynamic equivalent to paraphrase. But when you get to paraphrase, what you're saying is you read the text and then you just reword it completely, however you think it should have been said. So I certainly would lean more toward the New American Standard. The New King James would fit in there as well. And the English Revised Version as being much more strict translation. Readability. Well, that's a subjective thing, but some of these newer translations are a lot readable. The Living Bible is very readable. But if you've got a trade-off between accuracy and readability, which do you prefer? Obviously, the accuracy. But some of the translations are a little easier to read than others. If I find this, I look for this today. Good night, too. I know I've had it one time. I have a page from the original King James Version. If I find it, I'll print a copy and put it out there for you to try to read it, how hard it is to read today. And then the question of the textual basis. You have to do a little digging to find that out. But a lot of these translations in the very beginning, they will tell you whether they used like the King James, the Textus Receptus, or the Nestle text, or some of the newer Greek text to work from. Well, a lot more could be said about translations than that, but I thought that would be enough. Does anybody want to add anything before we move on? Any questions? Okay. Let me switch horses here, if I can get it to work. And we'll begin talking about the Psalms.